You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And hello to you, Grant, if you're listening. And, of course, being the second Wednesday of the month, between 1 and 2, we have our friends in from Hutchinson Legal to talk all things legal. We've got some questions to catch up from last month. We sent them away. We've got about three to send them away this time, and a couple of them are going to be very fascinating. So we'll see how we go. But first of all, let me introduce Phil and Ryan. How are you two?
Good, thank you. Good, good to be here. Thanks, Alan.
Good to see the two of you. Now, last week, or last month, we sent you away with a question on beyond reasonable doubt, because a jury, as I understand it, and the question was that a jury has to decide beyond reasonable doubt. But what is reasonable doubt? And I might have one interpretation of what reasonable doubt is, and Ryan might have another, but I'll bet there's a legal definition.
Yes, so it is actually not as straightforward, or you might imagine that maybe, you know, just looking at those individual words, it's not intended, that meaning is not intended for you, those words are not intended to be broken apart or overanalyzed.
Yep.
It's essentially the jury is supposed to reach their own conclusion in the circumstances. So it's not meant to be mathematical, so anything like
that. But that brings a little bit of doubt, because it's not quite black and white, is it, when you put beyond reasonable doubt? But black and white was either guilty or not guilty, but this you have to be beyond reasonable doubt. So I guess we're playing with terms, but the question was, how do you decide what is beyond reasonable doubt?
Yep, so just to give a very brief background. So beyond reasonable doubt is in the criminal circumstance, that is the burden of proof that the prosecution has to, so they have to prove all the elements of a criminal offence beyond a reasonable doubt. And essentially the jury, it's their task to figure out what their understanding of that is, with the assistance of a judge, just to push them along. But the judge does not strictly tell them what that means. It's for them to, you know, they have to do their job. They have to, you know, be reasonable and, you know, look at all the evidence and not, you know, try their best. But
so are we saying if the juror, and we'll talk about each individual juror now rather than a thing. So if I'm sitting on a jury, or Phil's sitting on a jury, and you've got some doubt that this person did it, then you really can't say guilty, can you? You've got to be assured that person didn't do it to get them off. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
I can add to that.
Yeah.
That's right, and it is what Ryan's getting at is it is really, at the end of the day, up to the juror to answer that question, the question that's been put. Now, as Ryan's mentioned, the court, the judge will give them some guidelines. Yep. They will say things like what a reasonable doubt is. You know, it's a reasonable, not a fanciful doubt.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it is the juror's decision what that means. All the court needs to hear from them is whether or not they've satisfied that the elements have been proven to that standard. So it's, and as Ryan said, it's not mathematical. It's not 99% or 98% or anything like that. The courts have been pretty clear to say this is not a mathematical exercise.
Right.
So the jurors get the guidance from the judge, but at the end of the day, they are the ones that sit down and do that interpretation that we're sort of trying to do now.
Yep.
And that's the nature of jury trials in general. It is, to an extent, subjective, and to an extent does depend on each juror's mind. And that's the very nature of that system being judged by your peers.
At times you can't get 100% jury, is it? Because what you think is reasonable doubt, as I said before, might not be what I envisage too. So there's two different things there.
That's exactly right. It can certainly differ from one juror to another, and that's why going to a trial for anything has an element of uncertainty, no matter how strong one side might think their case is. You're not trying to prove things to the letter of the law. You're trying to convince a group of 12 people to a subjective extent. That's what your goal is.
Who don't have any legal training.
Exactly. They get guidance. And as Ryan's mentioned, if they do things that are outside the guidelines or the rules that the judge has set, then things can be overturned.
Yep.
For example, a very high-profile example of this was a few years ago now when the late Cardinal Pell appealed his conviction to the High Court.
Yep.
And the High Court decided that the jury was wrong, basically, because there's no way that they could have found him guilty beyond reasonable doubt with the evidence that was provided. That's obviously trimming it down a fair bit.
Yep.
But so it's not as though there is no way the jurors can do it wrong. You know, the court can find that there's been some mistake or some error.
Yep.
But that decision ultimately rests with them as to whether or not they are convinced.
All right. I've got to take a quick break, and then, Phil, you're going to tell us about the second part of the question that we asked you.
Yep.
You must have heard of a little Bo Peep. She was the gal with all the sheep. Oh, well, one day it's sad to see the sheep all ran away. She was lonely and she was blue. She was sad and a-crying too. So I told her what to do. I said, put on your dancing shoes.
Put on your dancing shoes.
A friend of mine had an accident. Laughed so hard off of what he went. Humpty Dumpty was his name. I guess you heard the same. He was lying on the ground. Bits and pieces all around. So I told him what to do. I said, put on your dancing shoes.
Put on.
Sure you know about Jack and Jill. They're the ones that went up the hill. Jack fell down and broke his crown. Jill came tumbling after. What a noise their crying made. It was a ringing through the glade. So I told them what to do, and I changed their tears to laughter.
Put on your dancing shoes. Put on.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
We talked to our friends from Hutchinson Legal. We also sent them away with another question about self-defence. So, Phil, you want to tell us about that, please?
Certainly. So, yes, the question was, how is reasonable force determined in self-defence? And this was specifically...
Particularly in your own home.
In a home invasion, yep. Yeah. So, to piggyback off what we were talking about before, the ultimate answer to that is actually, well, it's a question for the jury as well.
Yep.
Because... in a trial, the jury are the ones that will determine that question, yep. What's reasonable. But I'll just quickly touch on what the test actually is.
Yep.
It's not actually reasonable force. There is a twofold test, which is in legislation in the Crimes Act. It used to be in common law, just not written law, just law made by the courts, but it's now in legislation.
Right.
And the two things are, number one, that the accused person believed the conduct was necessary. So that's a subjective belief.
Yep.
And number two, that the conduct was a reasonable response in the circumstances as that person perceived them. And that last bit is important, as that person perceived them, because, for example, if somebody's brandishing a toy gun at you, but it looks like a real gun, and yep. you have every reason to believe it's a real gun, then you're perceiving it to be real. So your response is based on that, not on the fact that it's not actually a real gun.
Yep.
So in terms of home invasions, what I've just described, that is basically the extent of the test. So necessary is the determining factor, what's necessary. And that's obviously a very broad question.
Necessary to protect yourself and family.
Yes, yes. That's not actually specifically what it says, but that is the logical interpretation.
Yep.
So necessary to stop the crime from happening.
Yep.
Right? Now, the Act also specifically says that you can only raise self-defense to a murder charge, so if you have killed somebody, if you were in danger of dying yourself. So that what that means is if somebody's broken into your house and they're trying to steal things from you or attack you, then you cannot kill them in self-defense.
Yep.
Right? Now, there's different extents to that. It's not only... You can raise it for murder if you're at risk of what they call really serious injury, which can include things like very serious sexual assaults. So you can respond with a homicide in certain circumstances. But it does depend on a case-by-case basis. So with a home invasion, there are many different things that could entail. It could just be somebody who's broken in to steal things.
Steal your car.
In which case, and the Act does say you can protect yourself or another person, or you can also protect property. So you can use, force and what would be otherwise a crime to protect your property. You can grab someone, which would be assault, to take your property back, for example.
Yep.
But it has to be reasonable in those circumstances. Now, if someone's broken in with a knife and they're slashing at you, trying to, kill you or seriously hurt you, then yes, it might be a reasonable response for you to seriously hurt them back or to even kill them if your life is in danger. But it really does depend on the circumstances. And ultimately, as I've said, that will be a question for the jury. So if a charge was to go to trial and it's the defendant would raise self-defense... and at that point, it's actually the prosecution has to prove that they didn't act in self-defense. It's not the defendant or the accused.
Oh, don't they?
Yeah. So as soon as you raise that as an accused person, the onus flips back to the prosecution. They have to prove to the jury, again, beyond reasonable doubt, that you didn't act in self-defense. And that's the test that will come into it. So again, the judge would give the jury directions on those two tests as to what they have to consider. But at the end of the day, it is a question for those 12 jurors to decide whether or not what the accused did was a reasonable response.
Good.
Yeah.
All right, we'll take another quick break. I know you've had a win in the courts and you're keen to tell us about it.
Absolutely.
And we're keen to hear about it. So we'll take that next.
scrapes and gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, welcome back to Community Connections. If you do have any questions, it's probably getting a bit late for today, but certainly either give Greg a ring out there on 59615991, 59615991. We've already got three questions to send them away with. We'd be happy to send them away with a couple more, or sometime between now and this time next month, just send an email to info@yarravalleyfm.org.au. And I'll get it, and we'll put it onto the people. Now, Phil, you've had this win. Tell us about it.
Yes, so it's a little bit of a case study. This particular case involved a roadworthy certificate that had been issued by a mechanic, and our client was the person who bought the vehicle in reliance of that certificate. So to give you a very brief summary, basically our client wanted to purchase a vehicle. He became aware that the vehicle had been in quite a serious accident some years prior.
He bought the car.
Before he bought the car. He knew that it had been in an accident.
Yep.
And because of that, he said, I'm not buying it without a roadworthy certificate. Now, that's my recommendation, is to not buy anything without any car without a roadworthy certificate.
Absolutely.
Regardless of whether or not you think it's been an accident. But having said that, yes, the client, you know, did everything right. He said to the seller, go and get a roadworthy certificate. I'm not buying it without one. So the seller did that. This assessor looked at the car, signed off, said nothing wrong with it. And then a few months later, after purchasing the vehicle, the client became aware that the outside of the vehicle had been fixed up following the accident, but the inside was basically a mess. It was not repaired to any reasonable standard. There was still quite a lot of cracking to the bodywork, and it was definitely not roadworthy.
Yep.
So then he came to us and said, you know, what can I do? He'd spent quite a bit of money on the vehicle, and now he has this dangerous vehicle that's not roadworthy. Now, he could have gone after the seller, but obviously the seller's pretty innocent in these circumstances, because they've gone to the mechanic and said, I want to get a roadworthy assessment. So it's really comes down to the mechanic, because that roadworthy certificate was issued very shortly before purchase, and that's what the client had relied on.
Yep.
So we ended up taking the matter to court. It didn't settle as these matters usually do, and went all the way to a trial, and the court found that basically because the mechanic had not done a proper inspection, that he'd engaged in misleading and deceptive conduct under the Australian Consumer Law. So that was basically our argument, was when a mechanic signs off that they've done a roadworthy assessment, they're signing off that they've complied with all the VicRoads requirements.
Yeah.
And obviously that's not happened, because the mechanic would have noticed all of these horrible issues with the car. We also put forward an alternative claim that he'd been negligent, but that didn't need to be proven because we got the first one proven, the misleading and deceptive.
I guess the other thing is too that the mechanic you would think would lose his licence for being allowed to issue roadworthy certificates too.
You would think that. That's not something that our client as a private individual could really do anything about. That's a matter for VicRoads.
Yep.
And if you ever have an issue like this with a roadworthy, you should go to VicRoads straight away, because they have a lot of oversight over the people who are registered assessors.
Yep.
And the requirements are quite stringent. But in this circumstance, I don't believe the mechanic was removed from the register. No.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why, but again, that's not for us to question. That's VicRoads' internal policy.
Yep.
But certainly, yes, you should report anything like this to VicRoads. But yes, we were able to sue for an amount of money which covered the loss and damage that our client had suffered, which was basically the amount that he'd spent on the vehicle less the salvage value of the vehicle. And the salvage value was a lot less than what he paid for it.
I was going to say the salvage value would have been worth a lot.
Yes, when you're salvaging it to someone who actually knows the state of the car, it's a lot less than what he had paid for the vehicle.
All right, we'll take another quick break, and then we're going to talk about council planning, and then I'll be going to give you some questions.
Dream so real. One can talk about being in love. Two can say how it really feels. One can you. Just take two. It takes two, baby. It takes two, baby. Make a dream come true. Just take two.
Listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, Phil, you want to talk about council planning and also if you do the wrong thing.
Yes, this is it's a bit of a PSA. It's something that I've seen come up quite a bit in my practice, is the consequences of breaching council planning schemes, which a lot of people do completely inadvertently.
Yep.
So just by way of a very brief background, each local council or shire is empowered to create a planning scheme, which is a horrendously long document. They're hundreds and hundreds of pages long, which basically tell the residents of that municipality what they can and can't do on their property and what they need a permit for.
Yep.
And that covers a huge, huge range of different things.
It seems to be getting more and more all the time.
Yes,
too,
but, exactly. Yep. And basically the council has the ability, if they become aware that something has been done that would normally need a permit, without a permit, they can take either civil or criminal action against the owner of the property where
they
it's
can
happened.
Make you pull it down too, can't they?
Yes. So that's first thing they can do is they usually issue notices. So the criminal charges, that you actually become criminally liable as soon as a breach occurs, but the councils will usually give you some time to rectify the issue first.
Right.
So they'll start with a notice, usually a letter. They say, hey, you've breached the planning scheme. This is what we want you to do. Either pull it down, or you can actually go, sometimes, not always, you can go and apply for a retrospective.
So you can do that. I didn't think you could. So you might be able to get a retrospective one.
Yes, yeah. Again, it's not always an option, and the council can just say no, it's not open to you, but certainly that is an option. You can go and get a permit for something that's already done. And that can cover a broad range of what's called works. So that can be tearing things down, putting things up. Big one is removing vegetation.
Exactly. You gotta say that.
That is very big, particularly native trees, and among native trees, particularly eucalypts. Eucalypts are very heavily protected by council planning schemes. And again, there are exceptions. For example, there's often allowances. I mean, the planning scheme does differ from council to council, but there are often allowances for if a tree is within a certain distance from a building.
Particularly in the fire areas up around the hills.
Yes. So there are other what they call bushfire overlays, which is sort of rules that can sometimes supersede the normal rules to say, well, you're in a bushfire prone area, so you have different requirements and different things you can do with your vegetation because of the risk for bushfires. So the PSA is, if you're going to do anything at your property, just keep that in your mind and think about whether or not you need to, number one, go speak to the council. There are also planning consultants that you can engage to do that for you. They're experts in talking to the council and experts in doing permit applications and that sort of thing. It will generally only come to me when it's past that point and there's a breach. So the council can take civil action in VCAT for enforcement to get orders that you have to do certain things to fix the issue. And as I've said, they can file criminal charges against you, usually in the magistrate's court. But it can go as high as the Supreme Court if a VCAT enforcement proceeding has gone ahead and orders have been made and those orders have then been breached, so you still haven't done what you're supposed to do. It can sometimes result in further criminal prosecution in the Supreme Court.
Fair enough. All right, we'll need to take one more quick break. Then I'm going to come back. I'm going to give you the questions for next time. And then Ryan's going to talk about a new ID scheme.
Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Right, we've got some questions. We've had three different people ring up with different questions. A couple of them are probably... we're not looking for assumptions. We're looking for what the actual law says on these cases. The first thing is potholes. And we're all hearing about potholes. But the question's been put to us, you're driving down the road, and because sometimes these are at night, and you can't see. I actually did $5,000 damage to the front end of my car. But this is not my question. Who's responsible for the damage? First of all, some people say that anything over $1,500, Vic Roads will pay. Some say, no, it's $5,000. So we want to know what limit it is. Secondly, I thought government departments were supposed to settle any of their debts in about 30 to 40 days. Some people are saying 6 months later they still haven't got any money, so we'd like to have a look and see if that's legal. And the third thing is, you're coming down a highway, at the last moment you see this big pothole, you swerve, the car rolls, and somebody is badly injured or worse. Who's responsible? Now, you didn't see the pothole, it's at night, but are Vic Roads responsible? Or is the driver responsible? Should the driver have been...
So, sorry, just to clarify, is it you see the pothole and you try and avoid it, or is it...
Yeah, you see the pothole and it's the very last thing. It just comes up on your headlights. And you roll the car, someone is badly injured or killed. Who's responsible?
Yeah.
Right, so that's the first
question. Good question.
Righto, another one. You're driving down the highway, and I actually went to Gippsland yesterday. You're in a 100K zone or 110, doesn't matter what it is. You're coming to a situation where it's 80 Ks. Now, where does that 80 Ks apply? Is it when you see it? Because that's quite a bit down the road. Mm. Or is there an imaginary line across the road so that once you've crossed past that sign, you could immediately get booked if you're doing over 80? So where is it? Is there an imaginary line? And I saw one yesterday, but this is very unusual, where the sign on the left and the sign on the right weren't opposite each other. This one's here and the other one's about 4 metres down the road.
Yeah.
So is there an... I mean, that's just being a bit facetious because that's... someone's made a mistake. But is it a line across the road and you have to be at 80 by the time you get to that, or where does it come into? Mm-hmm. So we'd like you to have a look at that. And the third one is bail. I think every time...
Love those bail questions.
I know Grant's getting sick of hearing about bail, but the government announced yesterday that they're changing the rules on bail. Now, some of the commentators said, yes, it has changed. Others said, well, no, it's really the same wording, just jazzed up. So we'd like to have a look at what the bail... conditions are today, and hopefully by the time you come back in a month's time, this will be legislated or not. And if it is legislated, what's the difference? Because some are saying it won't make the kids will still keep getting bail. Others are saying, oh no, it's going to be harder for them to get bail. So if you could just do a bit of a comparison, what's happened? We're not here to slag off of the government or anything like that, but we just want to know, are the changes real and what difference they're going to make? So there's a bit of homework and all that.
Mm.
Now, Ryan, you want to talk... No, we're going to have an Australia card years ago, which went nowhere. So you're saying that there's a new ID scheme coming in?
Yes, so yesterday the federal government has announced that they intend to do a trial of what they call a digital IT scheme. So essentially this is on the back of... recent data breaches and, concern about people being scammed and bad actors accessing people's sensitive information.
Yep.
So their proposal is similar to when, during COVID we would scan QR codes to check in. So similar sort of app on your phone where instead of handing over to, it might be a potential employer or a bank when you're getting a loan, instead of having to hand over your email your, passport or, other very sensitive information, you just show a QR code and that the business or the organisation uses that and it talks to the government.
So what's going to be in that QR code? Is it going to be Alan Collier, X amount of years and da-da-da, or is it going to be have other personal details in it? Do you know if they announced that yet?
So it will be the same sort of information, so your date of birth, and you can also, they intend to be, there be tiers of what information is required. So if there's like a bank loan, for example, obviously the bank would require lots of information before entering into an agreement. But essentially, instead of the bank or the person you're talking to physically seeing all that, or you physically handing all those documents, there's a what they call a handshake, So we're virtually in the background.
Yep.
So essentially, you're handing your information to less people. And so there's less chance of it being stolen, in theory at least.
So just to clarify, my understanding is that instead of, you know, normally you'd have 100 points of ID, which is usually your passport and your driver's license. Instead of you handing your passport over, there's some data, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ryan, that says the government's seen your passport, so that's ticked off, rather than the bank having to see it. Is that essentially what it is?
So you don't actually hand or you don't actually show them the passport. You just show them the tick, basically, that says we've seen this. Is that how it goes?
Yep. And instead of them storing that, when you hand it over, they would store that on their own, you know, servers, or they would hold on to that information. Yep. This is to prevent that. So you're giving out your information less, so there's less chance of, you know, bad actors, cyber criminals accessing it.
Now, I'll just be the advocate. We've had so many things, data breaches. How are they going to make sure that Joe Bloggs doesn't get all my information and then go off and open a bank account and start trading as me?
So it is kind of a double-edged sword. So instead of there being lots of points where your data, so your sensitive information is being stored, the government's proposal would be to store that in one location. The potential issue with that is if they access that one location...
That's what I was trying to get
it
at.
It could be disastrous. So
I think something to consider, though, is all of these documents, all these IDs, come from the government to begin with. So it's not like we're giving the government anything they don't already have. They're the ones that issue your passport.
Yep.
VicRoad's a government agency. They issue your driver's license.
Yep.
So it's keeping it basically in the hands of the entities that created the ID in the first place.
And I see now, because I got a thing the other day to say that the next driver's license I'll get will be on the phone.
A digital one.
I won't be getting this thing posted out that say who I am and all that sort of jazz. I'll just get it on the phone.
Yeah, VicRoads actually, so there was a trial earlier this year, but now that is rolled out. So today you can download the VicRoads app, and I believe you can use the same app that you used during COVID to check in.
Yep.
You can load your license into those apps and have them on your phone today.
Because I don't get any notification of registration on my car anymore. All I get is a thing that pops up from VicRoads, and I've got an app, and I just go in there and pay it on the app, and away it goes.
Yes, I remember I used to have to put the sticker up in your windshield, and that's how the police would know you hadn't registered. But now I guess they have to scan each license plate to check.
Well they can, and the Highway Patrol car's doing that all day long. Yeah. I can even go back further. When I was just a little bloke, you weren't allowed to touch you weren't allowed to put the sticker on the window. And once you paid the registration, my father would have to go down the police station. He used to put it on, the policeman would take the old one off and put the new one on. And he used to say, and I can remember, because I was really only little, because I'm not that old, but I can remember the policeman would say to him, eyes on, hands off.
Mm.
You can look at it, but you are not to touch that label.
No,
that's what he used to use. And as he finished, he'd say, eyes on, hands off.
Well, I guess at that point, you could be absolutely sure whether or not the car's registered, because it had to be done by the police.
Well,
I don't think they'd have time to be doing that to everyone's car in this day and age.
They wouldn't.
It'd be chaos.
But that's true. You used to have to go down to your police station and collect it, and he would put it on. Anyway, that's going back when I was just a little kid. So things have changed, and we are getting into the digital age. And I don't have a problem with that. The only thing that I just want to always make sure is they're secure, because everyone tells me everything's secure, and then all of a sudden they say, oh, we've had a bit of a data breach.
There's been a few of those, yeah.
Well, I mean, all your medical stuff now, I don't know about yours, but all mine's on an app.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I can tell straight away all the injections I've had, and when I last saw the doctor, mine's all on that. So
it's convenient.
Yeah, providing everything keeps going well. Look, we're fast running out of time. Phil, have you got anything else you want to... Oh, let me just backtrack a minute on your council planning that we were talking about.
Yes, certainly.
Is it true now that you don't... I think it's up to $5,000. If you're doing like a deck or something that's not over $5,000, you don't need a permit. Do you know if that's right?
Well, again, it depends on the planning scheme because every council has their own...
Oh, so it's not a blanket.
I believe we're in the Yarra Ranges Shire Council here. They have their own planning scheme. I've never encountered a dollar limit, but having said that, planning law is very broad and complex. But from my experience, it is not. That's not what it's determined on. It's just determined on whether or not it fits into a category of works that require a permit. And I've certainly seen things, for example, tree removal. You can get a tree knocked down for a lot less than $5,000, but one tree can land you in court.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't mean that. I have a feeling someone once told me that, or that they changed the rules. If you're just doing a small little deck, you know, $3,000 or $4,000, you didn't need a permit.
I think often the councils won't... Even though they might legally be able to go after you, they might not. And it might be an internal policy decision where they say, we're not going to go after jobs under 5,000. But that would be it's a discretion of the council. They can basically pick and choose who they want to enforce against and who they don't.
Is it true, and I guess this is probably not fair to ask you this, but I'm still going to ask you.
Go ahead.
Somebody once told me, and you touched on this briefly before, that they can make you pull it down, even if it is up to standard. If a council gets really, really mean on you, they can make you pull it down, get a permit, and then allow you to rebuild it. Do you know if that's true?
Yes, yeah. I mean, the issue is not that it's not up to standard. The issue is it doesn't have a permit. The issue is the council didn't let you do that.
Yep.
So, yes, in terms of standards, that's more when we're talking about building permits and the Building Act as to, you know, being built to a compliant regulation.
Yep.
But the planning issue is... It sets out a bunch of things where you just need the council to let you do something. It's not a question of the quality of the work or the height or anything like that.
Yep.
So, yes, you could build a really good compliant deck or shed and the council could say, you know, it would be pretty counterproductive to say tear it down, get a permit, rebuild it.
But they could.
That's why you'd want to go for a retroactive permit.
Yeah.
But they will say either, usually the notice will be, you have until this date to tear it down or to make an application for a retroactive permit. But it is discretionary. They can... take it whichever way they want. They can just say, nope, you got to tear it down no matter what.
Because, I mean, somebody told me that they can do that. As I say, I'm not 100% sure, but...
They certainly could, as in they can issue an order. If something has been built without a permit, they can issue an order that you must remove it.
And it doesn't matter that it's been built to specifications, does it? You just haven't built it.
Unpermitted, yeah.
You just didn't... Or you thought you'd beat the council.
Exactly. And look, if it's a perfectly good structure, usually you will be able to get a retroactive permit.
Yeah.
But the issue is, the council says we want to know about it. We want to record the permits. We want to know what works are being done so that we can maintain the standard of the council area.
And I would certainly never, ever suggest that people don't get the permit. And somebody told me, particularly down the Mornia Peninsula, they actually fly over the area every so many years and they take photos.
Aerial photos are a big way that they find out about these things.
Yeah, I'd heard that.
You don't even need to necessarily send someone over. You can just go on Google Earth. You can go on Google Maps and get an aerial view and you can wind the clock back 5 years and you go, oh, look, that tree was there 5 years ago.
Can you?
Yeah, yeah. And look, here's one from last year. The tree's gone. That's evidence of tree removal there.
So they don't even have to actually physically come onto your property and see that it's gone?
No, they're not always. Yeah, they can. There are a lot of ways they can find out.
So
that's why the recommendation is, you know, make the inquiries, get approval before you go ahead with this stuff, because it's a lot more heartache and probably a lot more expensive to be dealing with someone like me after the fact when you've got charges or you've got... VCAT cases going.
And to be honest, and I'm not having to go at any legal people there, it's going to be a pretty hard case to win, isn't it, up against the council if you've done the wrong thing?
Yes. I mean, look, there is sometimes leeway because there's often arguments about whether or not the works fit into the definition in the planning scheme. So the council might say, no, this requires a permit, and you'd say, no, this is... You know, I read the planning scheme differently and I say it doesn't require a permit and then you go to VCAT and VCAT will decide. So there is some room to move, but often it's particularly with the criminal charges, very difficult to escape liability. Yeah.
That's fair enough too. All right, guys, look, it's about time, unfortunately, to wind it up. We'll, at the same time, the second Wednesday of next month, which will be September. Jim.
Yes, it's getting on, isn't it?
Kicking on. Yeah. You'll come back with the answers on the potholes,
yep.
the speed limits,
yep.
and also bail. So thank you for coming along.
Thanks for having
enjoy
us.
Enjoy the rest of your day. It's a beautiful day outside, they tell me.
It is lovely out there.
So be good, Spud. Have you been down the street for lunch?
Yeah, I think we'll do that now.
Hightailed
it over here.
Sounds good. Yeah. Look, guys, thanks for coming along again, and we'll have somebody from Hutchinson Legal along same time next month, and we'll have the answers to those. And as I said, if you've got any questions between now and then, send an email to Greg and we'll get you some answers. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.